Romans chapter 13, we're going to cover today, verses 8, 9, and 10. Before I read that, I would like to ask the question that you could think about. What is the greatest sin? What is the greatest sin? And in preparing this message, I looked up what some people might think is the greatest sin, and you get a wide variety of answers, especially if you look on the internet. Of course, many Christian websites go right to the unpardonable sin, the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. Some other people, unbelievers and believers alike, gave a plethora of answers, and I'll just give you a few examples of that. One person said the greatest sin is independent thought. Many people said it was idolatry. Some generalized and said disobedience or breaking the rules. One Catholic website said the greatest sin is abortion. One Hindu monk said the greatest sin is to think yourself weak. Dennis Prager, who you may have heard of, who is a Jewish conservative talk radio show host, said the greatest sin is committing evil in the name of God. He says that every yeshiva student learns early in life that the greatest sin is the public desecration of the name of God, and conversely, the greatest commandment is the public sanctification of the name. Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, famously said, "The greatest sin is bringing children into the world that have diseases from their parents, that have no chance to be a human being practically. Delinquents, prisoners, all sorts of things just marked when they're born. That, to me, is the greatest sin that people can commit." One Muslim website said that the greatest sin is to contradict the purpose of one's creation. The Prophet Muhammad said that the gravest sin was to give God a partner, though he created you alone. Worshipping others besides God is the only unforgivable sin, and essentially involves giving the attributes of the Creator to a part or parts of the creation. I found interesting, one famous actor, Christian Bale, was relaying advice he got from his father. He said, "The greatest sin is being boring." And then Brazilian writer Paulo Coelho said, "The greatest sin is to miss the point of human existence." So many ideas exist about what the greatest sin is. This summer, as we were going through Christianity Explored, Brother ADL brought up a good point. In order to answer what the greatest sin is, we have to understand what is the greatest commandment. In Matthew chapter 22, we have this famous passage where they're asking Christ, "What is the greatest commandment?" You know, the law is filled with many different commandments. Which is the greatest one? And of course, they were trying to trap Jesus again. In Matthew 22, I'll just read to you verse 34 through 40. "But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. 'Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?' And he said to him, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets.'" And we hear that and we think, only these two? Aren't there 600 some odd commandments? And only these two? Jesus is saying that these are the ones that hang upon which hang everything that the law and the prophets contain. And it's interesting that Jesus doesn't just say the law, the first five books. He also says the prophets. So he's really taking a very exhaustive list of commandments and summarizing them in these two. To love the Lord your God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. So if these two commandments, the love of God and the love of neighbor, are the two greatest commandments, then obviously the greatest sin, logically, has to be the breaking of the greatest commandment. Remember, the Apostle John defines sin very clearly. He says, sin is transgression of the law. God says one thing, we do another. Sin, then, unlike what a coworker once told me, is tangible. He was trying to convince me that sin is sort of like an ideal. You really can't categorize sin. No, sin, according to John, is transgression of the law. It's very tangible. God says don't commit adultery tangibly, and you can tangibly break it by committing adultery. The law tangibly says don't bear false witness, and you tangibly break it by bearing false witness, and so on. You can tangibly sin, you can tangibly obey. Yet with all these rules, you tangibly obey God with one thing, according to this text in front of us. Love. If you love God and love your neighbor, you fulfill the law. Tangibly. So we look at our text, and in Romans 13, verses 8 through 10, it says this. Owe no one anything except to love each other, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. And there you have it. The Apostle Paul here is expanding on Jesus' teaching on the greatest commandment by telling us that the one who loves has fulfilled the law. Love is the fulfilling of the law. So when we think about the law, and we think about the amount of requirements, and sometimes we think about all these requirements that the law puts upon us, it seems overwhelming, but the answer for us to fulfill them is really simple. It's one word. Love. And so these three verses that we're studying tonight, I think they raise some questions. The first question I'd like to ask is this. What is meant by the law? When Paul says love is fulfilling the law, what does he mean by that? So let me briefly describe different aspects of the law. You may be familiar with the fact that theologians typically categorize the law into three categories. The moral law, the ceremonial law, and the judicial law. Sometimes you might see just the moral and ceremonial, and the judicial is more like a subset of that. Well, the moral law is, I think, what's most familiar to all of us. It's expressed clearly in the Ten Commandments, and they are a reflection of God's nature. Because God is holy, he expects us as his creatures to be holy as well, because we're made in his image. The moral law is God's standard of morality. In a world that increasingly changes standards, you know, based on emotion and feeling and whatever the current of the day is, God has unchanging standards. And that is codified in his moral law. So if you as an individual, you want to be moral, you can follow the rules that God gives us. In fact, if you want to be like God, just follow these laws. But the problem is you have to follow them perfectly if you want to be like God. And we know that none of us does that. So God is truth, therefore don't lie. God is pure, therefore don't commit adultery, etc., etc. The ceremonial law, a different aspect of God's law, includes those commandments given to Israel to keep them as a distinct nation which worships the one true and living God. Words that the Hebrew uses for this literally mean the custom of the nation. And they include things like holidays and fasting, liturgical ceremonies, suitable sacrifices, eating habits, so on and so forth. All of these things make Israel a unique people, but these laws are not ingrained in the heart like the moral law. For example, I think even those who deny God, vehemently deny God, they know that there's something immoral about murder. They might try to justify different aspects of murder. But we all know that there's something not right. The law is written on our hearts. That's the moral law. But we don't innately know the proper times to offer a meat sacrifice and a drink sacrifice. The ceremonial law is not written on the heart like the moral law is. The third kind of law is the judicial law, which is simply Israel's way of enforcing their other laws. It includes the consequence of disobedience. For example, when to exile someone, when to stone someone, when someone has to serve, become a slave in a sense to pay off a debt that they've sinned against somebody else. So the moral law, the ceremonial law, the judicial law. And when you look at your text in verse number 9, when Paul says, for the commandments, and he gives examples, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. Obviously here, I believe we can say Paul has the moral law in mind. So you are fulfilling the moral law if you love. The summation of this whole teaching tonight is that adultery, murder, theft, and coveting can all be avoided if we simply love each other. Another aspect that we need to consider, though, is the two tables of the law. Now, we're narrowing it down to the moral law, and you may have heard that theologians will categorize the Ten Commandments in two tables. Calvin in the Institutes says, God has so divided his law into two parts, which contain the whole of righteousness, as to assign the first part to those duties of religion which particularly concern the worship of His Majesty. The second to the duties of love that have to do with men. So the first table is our relationship with God, the vertical, and the other is the horizontal relationship with man. So then which ones, where do we stop? Where do we draw the line? Well, the Westminster Confession is pretty helpful here. It says, this law, after his fall, continued to be a perfect rule of righteousness, and as such was delivered by God upon Mount Sinai in 10 commandments and written on 2 tablets, the first 4 commandments containing our duty toward God, and the other 6 our duty to man. So a helpful way is to look at it, 4 and 6. So if you'd like to go to Exodus 20, we'll just take a look at this very briefly. The 10 commandments codified in the 2 tables of the law. And I'll skim through a little bit for sake of time. But Exodus chapter 20 is the giving of the law through Moses. And in verse number 1, we find the first commandment, no other gods. I am the Lord, your God. Verse 2, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. The second, no graven images. Verses 4 through 4 and 5. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. You see, again, God is relating these commandments to himself and his nature. The third one, do not take God's name in vain. Verse 7, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. And then number 4, remember the Sabbath. Now, you might know there's some debate as to whether this is ceremonial or moral, but understand if that's one category. But if we put it in the 2 tables category, it obviously fits our relationship with God, not our relationship with man. So that's verses 8 through 10. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the 7th day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work. So these first 4 are all dealing with our worship toward God, how we as a human being respond to the true and living God, and we obey God by obeying these 4 commandments. But God also requires us to live in such a way where we love each other peacefully, and that's what the other 6 are for. So commandments 5 through 10, this is the part of the law, the second table, wherein we deal with one another. The 5th commandment is in verse 12. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. The 6th commandment, you shall not murder. The 7th commandment, you shall not commit adultery. The 8th commandment, you shall not steal. The 9th commandment, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And the 10th commandment, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, or you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. So that being said, we go back to our text. Paul is obviously telling us that specifically the second table of the moral law is obeyed by loving one another. So we went back earlier to Matthew, where Jesus is teaching on the greatest commandment. And when Jesus teaches on the greatest commandment, obviously he's covering the law in its entirety. He's saying that it covers both tables. But here Paul is primarily addressing the second table, our relationship with each other. This can be seen, how do we know it's relationship to each other? Because in the context, Romans 13, in its entirety, is an interpersonal chapter. Paul doesn't just come up with this out of the blue. Last week we spoke about our relationship to civil authorities. So Paul is obviously, he has in mind how humans deal with one another. He talked about submission to authority. And if you look back in verse 7, this is how he ends that passage about Christians and civil authority. It says, pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. You hear the word owed over and over again. And then verse 8, owe no one anything. So it flows from verse 7 to verse 8. Verse 7 naturally leads there. Don't owe someone honor. Don't owe someone respect. Give them what they deserve. Give them what is coming to them. In fact, Paul then says, don't owe them anything, except to love one another. For this is for all men, right? In one aspect, he's saying you got these civil authorities. But what do I do with my neighbor who's not my mayor or my governor or my teacher or my police officer? He's my neighbor. I still owe him something too. I owe him love. So as Warren Wiersbe says, Paul now is enlarging the circle of responsibility. According to Vine, the word that's translated neighbor there in verse 10 literally means the one near you. So look at the person next to you. That's the person that you owe love to, whether it's here at the Bible study or on a bus or in your house. You owe that person love. Now, of course, I have to say, it should be said that you cannot truly love each other if you don't first love God. So while Paul is focusing, I'm just giving the context here on the second table, of course this applies to its entirety. 1 John 4:20, if anyone says, I love God and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. Loving a fellow human being is simply a byproduct of loving God. Now let's face it, right? People are annoying. People are frustrating sometimes. People can be rebellious. People can be smelly. Yet our sinful selves are even more offensive in the nostrils of God, and He loves us anyway. Therefore, because God loves us, we ought to love our neighbors. And if you do this, you fulfill the law. So that begs the question. Were the hippies right? I mean, based on everything I just said, can we conclude with the Beatles that all you need is love? I mean, after all, this is really simple. But remember that Romans is Paul's, it's like Paul's magnum opus. Romans is a long excursion through theology and biblical teaching, very weighty, heavy biblical teaching. But Paul then brings it back here in chapter 13 to a very common level, and he says, after all this teaching I've given you, after all this theology, I want you to realize that if you're filled with the perfect love of God, you will know exactly how to act. So Paul here is not advocating some mushy, worldly love. Like the world often accuses us as Christians of being unloving because we have these principles we try to abide by. Or there's certain things, you know, that we just don't do. We refuse to do. And they think that's unloving. That's legalistic. And so true love means that there are no rules and anything goes. But that's not what Paul's advocating here. He's saying that love is the basis of obedience. The true basis of obedience. So in the name of love, the question is, do we throw the rule book out because we love? Is the law made void? Well, Paul answers that elsewhere in Romans. He says, may it not be. So what he's really saying here is not what the hippies are saying. What he's saying here is we have to understand the difference between knowing how to vainly abide by the rules and actually appreciating the rules for what they are. See, as a teacher, I delight when my students do what they're supposed to do, not simply because they know or because they know it's right, not simply because they have to. I love when students, for example, will volunteer to clean up or put things away because they know that a clean atmosphere is more conducive to learning. But what a difference between that and asking a student to help clean up and go the extra mile and they refuse to because it's not required of them. This is the difference between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. If you'll turn with me to Romans 7. Paul brings this out in a few chapters ago. Romans 7. We're not throwing the rule book out just because we fulfill the law through love. Romans 7, verse 1. Or do you not know, brothers, for I am speaking to those who know the law, that the law is binding on a person only as long as he lives. For a married woman is bound by law to her husband while he lives. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of marriage. Accordingly, she will be called an adulteress if she lives with another man while her husband is alive. But if her husband dies, she is free from the law, and if she marries another man, she is not an adulteress. So Paul pits marriage against our relationship now to the law. Likewise, verse 4, likewise, my brothers, you also have died to the law through the body of Christ, so that you may belong to another, to him who has been raised from the dead, in order that we may bear fruit for God. For while we were living in the flesh, our sinful passions, aroused by the law, were at work in our members to bear fruit for death. But now we are released from the law, having died to that which held us captive, so that we may serve in the new way of the Spirit and not in the old way of the written code. so interesting. It's almost contradictory if you don't understand what he's saying here. Because how in the world can you be released from the law and then go on to serve? How can that be? Because it's not the law itself that is null and void. It's our relationship to it. It no longer holds us captive. It no longer is the thing that we try to do and perform in order to earn favor with God. It's been abolished in the sense that Christ fulfilled it, but not abolished in the sense that it no longer applies. The law, Paul goes on to say in verse 7, what then shall we say? Is the law sin? By no means, he says. Yet if it had not been for the law, I would not have known my sin. And he goes on to talk about the importance of the law for the believer. So understand that even though we've been released from the bondage of the law, that the law is still good for us in guiding us to how we should live our lives. But the huge difference now is that now that we've been made alive in Christ, we're born again, we are led by the spirits of the law. We don't have to obey the letter like the Pharisees did, who obeyed as much of the jot and tittle of the law as they could, but yet in their hearts they were empty. This reminds me of Fiddler on the Roof a little bit, one of my favorite plays. And I love the scene where the husband and wife, Tevye and Golda, are sitting down. Now, you have to understand, if you haven't seen it, they had a traditional arranged marriage. Their marriage wasn't necessarily based upon love. And there's one of their famous songs about, "Do You Love Me?" And I love the dialogue that goes back and forth. It kind of reminds me of this concept. I'll read it to you. Tevye says to his wife, Golda, this is after about 25 years of marriage. He looks at her and he says, "Do you love me?" She says, "Do I what? Do you love me? Do I love you? Well," she says, "with our daughters getting married and there's trouble in the town, you're upset, you're worn out, go inside, go lie down. Maybe it's indigestion." Tevye says, "Golda, I'm asking you a question. Do you love me?" She says, "You're a fool." He says, "I know, but do you love me?" "Do I love you? Well," she says, "for 25 years, I've washed your clothes, cooked your meals, cleaned the house, given you children, milked your cow. After 25 years, why talk about love right now?" Tevye says, "Golda, the first time I saw you was on our wedding day. I was scared." She says, "I was shy." He says, "I was nervous." She says, "So was I." He says, "But my father and my mother said we learned to love each other. So now I'm asking you, Golda, do you love me? I'm your wife. I know, but do you love me?" She thinks, "Do I love him?" He says, "Well," she says, "for 25 years I've lived with him, fought with him, starved with him. 25 years my bed is his. If that's not love, what is?" And he says, "Then you love me." She says, "I suppose I do. And I suppose I love you too." And then together they say, "It doesn't change a thing, but even so, after 25 years, it's nice to know." I think there's a difference between being married because of law and being married out of love. And Paul says that let me read it to you one more time. He says, when the married woman is bound by the law to her husband while he lives, but if her husband dies, she's released from the law of marriage, right? Well, we're bound to the law. We're under captivity to the law. But now that we've been released from the law, the interesting thing is we still love it because we know it's holy and good. And we're no longer obeying it simply because we have to. Now, by the Spirit of God, we can obey the Lord because we want to, because we love Him. F.B. Meyer gives this great illustration. He says, this is like the way in which love fulfills is the contrast between the young servant girl and the wife, the mother and the housekeeper. When the girl enters the household, she has to act by rule. With some care, she's informed how to meet the various demands of the house and home. When to rise, how to prepare the food, the handling of the babe, the care of the children, the management of the kitchen, nursery, bedroom. But if she's married in perfect love, she will almost instinctively do all that. All the things she previously did by obedience to the rule. She will indeed do a great deal more. Wives and mothers will perform services for those they love, which no money would ever procure. Night after night, they will nurse the sick child with no thought of taking rest, and almost miraculously will compensate for lack of money, food, and every appliance on which the mere hireling would positively insist. In such cases, love is the fulfilling of the law. And I hope you understand the difference. There's one thing about being a hireling, but it's another to do things out of love. Because you love, these things are to come naturally. So we would all agree that laws are necessary due to the human condition. But laws cannot change hearts. The gospel does. And because of the gospel, we can love beyond the law. Now let's just take a look at how this all makes sense. Verse 10 says, love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. How can my love for my neighbor actually fulfill the law? Well, Paul gives four examples, and of course he says, and so on. So he's referring to much more than just these four. But these four he uses are adultery, murder, theft, and coveting. I could avoid these four if I love my neighbor. So let's take them one by one. Adultery. A man who truly loves God will not sin against his body, which God gave him. A man who truly loves God will not be unfaithful because he knows God is faithful. A man who truly loves his wife will not cheat on her because he loves her and she deserves his love and faithfulness. Adultery is an unloving act. It's really simple when you think about it. How about murder? A man who loves God will not take a life because only God is the life giver and the life taker. He realizes that each person is uniquely created in the image of God, and though sinful, has inherent worth and dignity. Not only so, since Jesus expanded this commandment to apply to hatred, a man who loves his neighbor will not destroy his neighbor with words, ruin his reputation, or slander his character. No, in contrast, the true loving man would want his neighbor to not only live, but enjoy an abundant life by giving him what he needs, especially the gospel. Theft. A man who loves God understands that God is the owner of everything, and he has no right to take what doesn't belong to him. A man who loves his neighbor realizes that robbing someone is unloving. It's taking something from someone sinfully. If you love your neighbor, you will want to give and not take. And then coveting. If you truly love, you will not covet, because a man who loves God is content with what he has, and his satisfaction is in God. If he loves his neighbor, he delights in seeing his neighbor not only live, but prosper. So if your neighbor has a nice house, or a happier family, or better behaved children, or a better job, you ought to be happy for your neighbor, because you love your neighbor, and you want the absolute best for your neighbor. You see how simple it is? If you love each other, you will avoid these sins, because love is the fulfillment of the law. I'm going to wrap it up quickly here with a detour, because this is a Bible study and I want to get into some of the interpretive issues here. So I want to ask this question, which you may have come across before. The question is, does Romans 13, verse 8a, teach that we are not allowed to get into debt? Romans 13, verse 8 says, owe no one anything. So is Paul saying you can never get into debt? Never take out a mortgage, a car loan, a school loan, use a credit card? Is this like the end all to all debt for everybody, everywhere, who names the name of Christ? And godly men have thought this. It's been said that J. Hudson Taylor and Charles Spurgeon felt that's what this verse was teaching, and they never got into debt as a result. Well, in my study of this, I really liked what William Barclay had to say, so I'm going to read to you this paragraph. It's a little lengthy, but I hope I can get across what he's saying here. He says, the previous passage, the one that we read earlier about civil authorities, dealt with what might be called a man's public debts. Romans 13:7 mentions two of these public debts, the tribute and the tax. By tribute, he means the tribute that must be paid by those who are members of a subject nation. The standard contributions that the Roman government levied on its subject nations were three. There was a ground tax by which a man had to pay, either in cash or in kind, one-tenth of all the grain and one-fifth of the wine and fruit produced by his ground. There was income tax, which was 1% of a man's income. Wow, a lot better than it is now. There was a poll tax, which had to be paid by everyone between the ages of 14 and 65. By taxes, Paul means the local taxes that had to be paid. There were customs duties, import and export taxes, taxes for the use of main roads, for crossing bridges, for entry into markets and harbors, for the rights to possess an animal, or to drive a cart or wagon. Paul insists that the Christian must pay his tribute and his taxes to state and to local authority, however galling it may be. And then, when we come to our text in verse 8, he goes from public to private. Private debts. And Barclay says, some abuse the Lord's Prayer, which tells us, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, as an excuse to let go of all monetary obligations. But Paul is saying that Christianity is not an excuse for debt. It's a reason to fulfill to the uttermost. As Origen said years and years ago, centuries ago, the debt of love remains with us permanently and never leaves us. This is a debt which we both discharge every day and forever owe. If a man wants to discharge this debt of love, he will automatically keep all the commandments. If you truly love your fellow man, you don't need any other law. You owe your neighbor your love every day. Understand that the Bible does not prohibit borrowing. It prohibits charging high interest, robbing the brethren, failing to pay honest debts, and of course we can do a whole study on this, and maybe we will. But it does advocate financial responsibility. So here, Paul is using debt as an illustration of how we owe each other love. So I think it's wrong to use this verse as it's not intended. It is not intended to be a prohibition against getting into debt. As G. Campbell Morgan says, it is impossible to pay off the debt of love. It's something that you owe someone every day. You might be able to return the salt to your neighbor, but you can't say, I've given you love on Tuesday, I don't owe you love on Wednesday. It's an eternal debt that you and I owe everyone else. So, Romans 13:8, verse 8a, cannot be used as a universal prohibition. We're almost taking it out of context if we say, because Paul said, owe no one anything. Now, as a Christian, you can't take out a mortgage. As a Christian, you have a high responsibility to be wise with your money and to pay back your mortgage on time. But there's nothing in this text that advocates against borrowing whatsoever. So now, having taken that detour, go back to our original point, and if you'd like to turn to 1 John chapter 4, we'll end there. First John chapter 4, I already read to you verse 20, so I will just read from verse 15 through 19. Whoever confesses that Jesus is the Son of God, God abides in him, and he in God. So we have come to know and to believe the love that God has for us. God is love, and whoever abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this is love perfected with us, so that we may have confidence for the day of judgment. Because as he is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. We love because he first loved us. If there's anything that should characterize the behavior of Christians in this lost and dying world, it is the love that we have for each other. But you know, while it starts in the household of God, we also know we have an obligation to even love our neighbors who may not be part of that household. We are to be loving to all, to even bless those who persecute us and pray for those who curse us and not curse back. And so our love, which begins with our love to God and extends then to our love for our brothers and sisters in Christ, should also expand to love beyond the walls of the church as well. And remember, when we come face to face with God's law and even the law of Christ, we don't do it based upon what John says, out of fear of punishment. We do it out of love. Because I love Christ. What did Christ say to his disciples? If you love me, you will keep my commandments. This is a very simple message this evening, but it's something that I think we need to remind ourselves of daily. I might be the proverbial five-star Christian, attending church services left and right, reading my Bible, checking off my devos, going out and evangelizing. But if I have not love, what does Paul say? Right? I'm nothing. And I think we're going to find that the Christian life is nothing more than a struggle. It's nothing more than going from one set of laws to another set of laws. If we don't realize that everything has to be based upon love. If we have love for one another, these commandments will flow naturally. If we don't have love, we're going to keep fighting against these commandments. The law is going to be to us something that even sickens us because we know we don't want to do it. But it shouldn't be so for the Christian. The Christian should naturally be able to put his arm around the unlovable. He should naturally be able to go the extra mile for his brothers and sisters. And if we're not doing that, we have to check our hearts. You know, we have a requirement at Bread of Life that every member is required to attend our business meeting. And I'm looking at Brother Joel because he wasn't able to attend the business meeting because of love, though. Because out of his love for his neighbor, he missed like 95% of it because he was bringing someone home who would never be able to get home if he didn't have that car ride. And this is like the whole principle of healing on the Sabbath, right? There's the letter of the law, then there's the spirit of the law. There's a time where our love for our brothers, or even our love for our neighbors, is going to supersede some sort of nitpicky, Pharisaic attitude toward the law. And that expression of love is something that glorifies God. And so I wrap it up by saying this. Let's not do good to each other because we have to. If we love each other, we will do good to each other. The greatest sin, answering the question I started from the beginning, is to fail to love. Because in failing to love, you will break God's holy law. But if you love, you will fulfill the greatest commandment. In fact, if you love right, according to our passage today, you fulfill the whole law.